This is an interview with Fred Michaels, August 2nd, 1987, at the Kiwanis Campground, Fort Peck, Montana, concerning the Fort Peck Dam Project.
Could you tell us briefly your life before you came to Fort Peck and worked on the dam, what you did?
Well, I was a farm boy in northeastern Montana, Sheridan County. My folks had a farm and ranch about 17 miles west of Reserve, Montana, about 22 or 25 miles southwest of Plentywood, Montana. I went to school in Medicine Lake for some of the grades, and then we had country schools for the grades. And I went to Plentywood, Montana for high school. Graduated in 1932. And I worked for my parents 1 year on the farm. In the fall of 1933, I went to Havre, Montana to enroll as a pre-med student. Spent 1 year of pre-med there in Havre, the North Montana College. And I didn't have money enough to enroll for a second year, and I had been working through the summer for the Buttrey Department Store. And this fall, the Buttreys were opening a store here in Fort Peck, a department store on the town site. So they offered me a chance to transfer to Fort Peck. And interestingly, I was brought to Fort Peck by old F.A. Buttrey himself. He had a 1933 Buick that was considered a fancy car in those days. And his accountant, Phil Palm, and F.A. Buttrey were in the front seat, and I, as a young man, was more or less ignored in the back seat. They talked about many things that I shouldn't have heard, maybe. But Buttrey's had this shell of a building as a concession, and they put us up in contractor's shacks. They had kind of barracks-like things that contractors had, I think Mason and Walsh probably. And we lived several weeks in those temporary barracks. And then Buttrey's moved a couple of those barracks to Wheeler and set them up. And they took care of all the male employees in these temporary shacks in Wheeler. And as things went along, we had to build fixtures and tables and things, stock the store for weeks and weeks. We unpacked boxes, marked clothing and stuff. And then Buttrey's built a more or less permanent barracks, a little to the west of the business district. There's nothing there now. And we had a real nice bunk house or barracks type of thing, two men to a room, central bath. And I worked for Buttrey's as a sales clerk for about June of 1936. My mother passed away after a gallbladder operation in Minot, North Dakota. And when I went back for the funeral, I just left Buttrey's. And when I come back after the funeral, I applied for work with the Army Engineer Corps. And that was a period where they said there was 10,000 workers here, so I guess jobs were easy to get. And with my background as a sales clerk and one thing and another, I qualified as a storekeeper. I went into civil service as a storekeeper at the tunnel warehouse. That would have been over here below the quite a little below, maybe a half a mile below these open tunnels over here. And worked as a storekeeper for a year, year and a half or so there, and then they started to close that down to make way for the spillway. And I transferred over to what was called the floodplain warehouse. It's over here where these buildings are now. And I was a storekeeper there, working in spare parts for Caterpillars and automotive type of stuff.
What kind of merchandise did Buttrey's?
Buttrey's had two stores in Fort Peck. One of the buildings about the center of that block, I would guess right about where the church stands now, they had a grocery store. There were several concessions. There was a meat market. Buttrey's couldn't handle meat. So they had a grocery store, and then to the far edge, just kitty corner from the theater, was a department store. Clothing, hardware, furniture, radios.
Was it the main store in Fort Peck,
yeah,
or in this area?
Yeah. There was always a bone of contention between the Barnholt drugstore down on the other corner. He wasn't supposed to handle hardware and stuff, but old Barnholt brought in quite a lot of hardware, and Buttrey's objected to that, but they never could do anything about it. But basically, ladies ready to wear, men's clothing, had some furniture, washing machines, refrigerators. Many times I had to go out and help deliver. Refrigerators were too heavy for one man, and furniture too heavy for one man. And, I was a storekeeper. May of 1938, I applied for work at the Los Angeles Flood Control Program in Los Angeles. And I was given permission to transfer. So in May of 1938, I left Fort Peck, transferred to Los Angeles, California.
Why did you need permission to transfer?
Well, it was an application for transfer. You wrote a letter from this district to the Los Angeles district. And they'd send a letter okaying the transfer, and you just drove out there.
You were working with the Corps at that time?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
And so it amounted to a transfer in grade.
How many employees did Buttrey's employ at the time? Remember?
This department store, must have been 12, 15. Had women in ready to wear, or ladies ready to wear, and they had two furniture salesmen, they had a hardware man, about five or six in men's clothing.
Do you recall what your wages were at that time?
Yes, very well. When I come from Havre to Fort Peck, I think I was $60 a month. And then we worked a lot of overtime unpacking all that stuff, and they would graciously give us $10 maybe a month. They worked at $70 and $80. I remember one time I was making $80, and my friend, the hardware man, had a 30 model Chevy. And I paid him $15 down payment and $15 a month on this. But I'd get about a $5 or a $10 raise, and when I quit the Buttrey's, I was getting $110 a month.
Is that considered a good wage?
Well, when I went with the government, you got $120 a month, so that was a little bit of a raise. In those days, it was pretty good. Up in Havre store, men with families worked for $60 a month. So as a young man, if you got 80 or 90, well, you're in pretty good shape.
Was there competition for that kind of job, working as a clerk as opposed to working on the dam site?
No, because at that time, as I said, in 1936, they had 10,000 workers here, and jobs were pretty, about all you had to do was ask for it. Mm-hmm. However, and if you went back to Havre, there were men walking the streets that were dang glad to get that job.
Do you recall having a large turnover in the butchery store?
Not particularly. The grocery type of clerk liked that type of work, and he'd stay with it. It was interesting compared to nowadays, in that tiny little grocery store that was, compared to grocery stores today, it was very small, but the clerks were salesmen. They wore a white apron, and you waited on everybody. A lady would come in and you followed her around and you tried to sell her more than she had on her list. And you carried the stuff in your apron. And if she was looking for peaches, you tried to sell her Del Monte rather than the house brand. And you were a sales clerk. You tried to sell this lady much more than what she came in with on her list. And then you took this apron full of stuff and went to the counter and you rung it up on the, you made a sales slip, handwritten. And then you rung the sale up and you boxed this. Many times they used boxes rather than paper bags like we use today.
People generally pay cash?
Oh yeah. Well, here checks were acceptable, but mostly cash. I don't recall Buttrys having grocery charge, but they may have. We had charge accounts in the department store.
Was there a local bank in Wheeler or any of the, or Fort Peck?
No. We had to go to Glasgow for our banking. And this was something they'd send one of us in by bus. The buses went about every half hour back and forth, and we would take the checks in and cash to make a deposit, and then we'd bring back cash. I remember one time I had to tote about 300 silver dollars, made quite a load on a box to carry. In those days, they favored making change with the silver dollar. The theory was that clerks made less mistakes by silver dollars, and so anything below five, you use silver dollars for change rather than paper.
Did you prefer doing the same?
I guess we were just educated to think that the silver dollars were easier. I can remember carrying a lot of silver dollars. We wore three-piece suits and carried these silver dollars in our vest pockets, and sometimes you'd have 8, 10, 15 of the dang things, and they kind of weigh you down pretty well.
You wore a three-piece suit. Did the store buy that for you, or did you have to provide your own clothes? Yeah.
But the suit in those days, you got a pretty good suit for 1950, and you got a real good suit for 2950. Got a Hart, Schaffner & Marks for 3450. We consider Hart, Schaffner & Marks as top. And that was an expensive suit, $34.50. And I wore 1950s as a rule, but that was a wool suit.
How did you clean your suits?
We took them to cleaners. They had a cleaning store in there too. You took them to a cleaner. I can remember in high school days when you took a suit to the cleaners, they spotted it. And if you had a bad grease spot, well, they rubbed chalk in it, brushed the chalk off, and it didn't come out, so I had to brush more chalk and pressed your suit and folded it up and brought it back to you in a package wrapped in brown paper. Didn't hang.
What was the ratio of men to women working as clerks for Buttrys or when you were a clerk working for the Corps?
Predominantly men, however, in the ladies' ready-to-wear. The grocery store was all men. A meat market was all men. Shoe store was all men. Predominantly men. In our department store there, they had a lady cashier and a lady bookkeeper. Rest all men. And, well, the ladies' ready-to-wear, I think. Three and four women and ladies ready to wear. The store is predominantly men.
You recall your boss at the Buttrys store, how you got along with him?
Hal Burdett. He was a kind of a stern old gentleman. Got along with him pretty well, but he was a pretty stern boss. And, of course, I was a kid among most of them. I think in that store I was probably the youngest. Maybe the delivery boy might have been younger. Most of the other had been men in their 30s, 28, 29, 30. I was 22.
And they set up a barracks for you. Was that close by?
We walked. Let me think if there's some. You know where the Conoco station is, up here on the main drag? It would have been a little bit to the northwest of that. I suppose we walked 6 or 8 blocks to work. I remember one morning it was 60 below zero, and we walked to work in just an ordinary top coat and a hat. We walked fast.
What did they call that area up where you lived?
I think a concessionaire's area there. The various concessionaires built a house for their boss. Lon Burdett had a house, and the guy that run the shoe store had a house. And the guy that managed Barnholt Drugstore, he had a house. The company would build that because it had to be a temporary building. The area is all bare now, but up in the hills there was a bowling alley, and the workers' barracks. I don't know if it had a barracks area, I guess. They named these barracks by numbers and alphabet letters.
What did you do in your spare time? The time that you had off shift or days that you had off? Recreation, social activities you participated in?
Well, our Friday and Saturday evenings, we'd go to the taxi dance halls, go from one hall to the other. In this bunkhouse, we played an awful lot of poker. Red. I can't remember listening to radio as much, but had some pretty hot poker games. And read books and magazines. Maybe get in the car and go to Glasgow, see a show. Well, the show run three or seven nights a week, and a matinee on Sunday. So we went to a lot of shows. Probably we went to a show every Wednesday night when they had the bank night, and probably every Sunday night.
What was a bank night?
Well, bank night, they had a big drum, and your name was in there on a card, a great big drum, maybe as big as this table. And about halfway through the show, the manager of the theater and one of the usherettes he'd spin this wheel and she'd pull out a card. And they give away dishes in those days. They'd win a set of dishes and then they have a cash prize. Maybe start out with $50 and if somebody won it this night, well then it'd be $75 or something next week. And then $100, they'd add to it every night until somebody got it.
Did you have to be present to win?
Yeah. Yeah, they called your name, and if you weren't there, they'd spin her and call another.
Life magazine did an article on this area, and particularly about the boom towns, and they said that anything goes type of atmosphere. Do you think that was true?
Yes, it was. I was here when this Margaret White, I think. And I was here when they took that, and I got a facsimile. I got a reduced copy of that First Life magazine. There was a cute story. I don't know if you want to put that on tape or not. Want it? Let's see if I can think of the names. This Lloyd Carlson could remember the names, but they had a captain in charge of the photographic department. If you seen all these pictures. They took thousands, maybe even millions of pictures. So they had a photographic department, and there was a captain and a lieutenant in this Army Corps. And they had civilians. But this captain and his wife and the lieutenant and this Margaret Ann White were going around taking pictures, and she didn't want to miss anything. She insisted that she see all of the places. Down below Wheeler, over the hill, was what they called the Riding Academy, or Saddle Club, various names. And so this captain's wife naturally wouldn't go in there. She sat in the car, and the captain and the lieutenant and Miss White went in to take pictures of this house of ill fame. Drunk comes along, staggering along, and he comes up the window of the car, and he propositioned this lady. She squirmed away from him, away from the window, and says, "I'll have you know I'm not that kind of a woman." And he staggered out. And, "Well, lady, what the hell are you doing down here?" And she says, "I'm waiting for my husband." He staggered back a couple of steps, and he said, "Jesus Christ, lady, but you're broad-minded." And this lady was supposed to have told this story on herself. I'm sorry, I can't give you the names. It just won't come to me. Well, that was true. I, as a Buttry employee, I was sent out to install linoleum and deliver furniture to these places. And We didn't do a very professional job. We just lay the linoleum down and cut it to fit the room and stomp it here and there. And I remember we went to this one place and the girl come out in just panties. And she'd just done a job on a guy, and Jesus Christ, it took him a long time to do the job. And she showed us her operation scar. She slipped her panties down and showed an appendix operation scar. I was with a young man that, we were both young. He was married. And she fooled around, you know, trying to put the make on us a little bit. And would you believe it? They worked for $2. $2. And I suppose she wanted another $2 out of one of us young fellas, but she didn't get it. We used to deliver furniture to those places. One was Macomb City over here, the other side of the river. Godforsaken little town back over in there. We'd deliver furniture, beds, mattresses, and heaters. Sometimes a radio. Well, the radios they could carry in those days. I remember one time down here at Wheeler, this madam come in and she complained that the heater we sold her wouldn't do the job. And she had a building with a lobby and then two bedrooms on each side of the lobby. And she expected this heater to heat the whole 5 rooms. And it was a very cheap, I think about a $49 oil heater. Very simple little thing, and it just would not heat that much square footage. So I was sent out, see what you can do with it. And I found that if I tipped the oil tank and put more, it was a gravity type feed of thing, and if I tipped the oil tank and spill a little more oil in there, well, then the pot, the fuel in the pot made a bigger flame. And it started to give off heat, but the thing was dancing with flames, and says, now if it worked like that, that'd give us plenty of heat. So I went up to a hardware store and I bought a piece of quarter inch rod. And I wound this rod around the base of this tank, and that raised the fuel level a whole quarter of an inch. I suppose if OSHA or some of these government agencies heard about it now, it'd have been a terrible thing, but I raised the capacity of this pot of oil there, and the little heater just sit there and shake and dance. That's giving us plenty of heat. I run like hell before the thing blew up. It never did, I guess.
Were taxi dancers frequented? Did people?
All the dance halls had girls. They weren't employed. They just, any girl could go in there and stand around. And the way it worked, you bought them a drink, and the bartender gave them Coke and 7-Up and stuff, and they didn't get alcohol. But you bought the girl a drink, and she got her cut from the bartender. I can't remember that they used tickets here. I know in the big cities, you bought tickets for a taxi dancer, but I think here they got their pay from the bartender.
Was there a distinction between taxi dancers and prostitutes?
Oh, yes, yes. Many of the taxi dancers were very nice girls. That was their choice. They wanted to be a prostitute and could find a place to work. Some of them built little shacks, tar paper shacks of their own. But at $2 a flop, you know, they didn't make very good wages. I'll always remember a friend of mine, a fellow I worked with over here at the warehouse. He was they called him Tiny, but he was about as big as half of this table, a huge man. And he bought a woman every Saturday night. And I often thought what an ordeal it must have been for one of those girls to service this huge hunk of a man. Oh my gosh. She earned her $2, I'll bet you.
What about criminal activity in the boom towns? Do you recall that much?
I don't think there was. People were poor, but you didn't have stealing of gas or stuff that I was aware of. You had your brawls where people get drunk and people get badly beaten. And there was, I guess there were some shootings. Just drunken brawls like we still have today. But pilfering and stealing, people didn't lock doors. And of course, you had just hundreds and hundreds of these little tar-papered shacks. And you could build an 8x10 or 12 shack for just a few dollars worth of lumber and a roll of tar paper. Put a bed and a stove in it, and that was about it.
What about medical facilities in the boom towns?
There was nothing but they had a medical clinic here in town, and they had a small hospital. And I think they probably had as many as four doctors sometimes. Some of them worked part-time here and part-time in Glasgow. But they did have a clinic with usually two doctors in it. But there were no doctor's office down in East Shack Town. Just weren't enough.
Do you recall major illnesses or epidemics that broke out?
Never any recollection of it. Most of the doctoring here would have been injuries, industrial or on-the-job injuries, and people falling and breaking a leg. Remember one time a little child here in the city fell on a tricycle that had been taken apart, and this open thing where the handlebars went in, a little child fell on that and actually punctured his cheek. And the mother took this chunk of flesh and the child screaming down to the doctor's office, and they filled it and sewed it back in place. But that was what doctors worked on mostly. I suppose they had venereal disease, quite prevalent. The old penicillin treatment for that.
You mentioned that a bowling alley was up by the barracks where you lived. Was that frequented often?
It had a good play. It run 24 hours, and people, because of the shifts, they bowled 24 hours a day. Yeah, and they had a little lunch counter, and I think sold beer and drink, just beer. Wouldn't have been wine or alcohol. I had an interesting experience when I was a storekeeper over here. They were going to have one of these usual inspections where you had to shine and get the place looking good for the visiting officials. And as a storekeeper, I was asked to provide paint for the painters to paint all the, instead of having guardrails like they got now, they had huge posts, I think maybe eight or a 10 inch rough sawn post, and they'd put in the ground, and there was a cable went through those for a guardrail. And they had to have a certain yellow. I think maybe in those days it was the official color for the State Highway Department. And it was a kind of an orangey yellow paint. And of course, we didn't have it in stock, and I don't know why they didn't send the Fort or to Glasgow to get it or something. But anyway, I was told to take a truck and some men and come from this warehouse over to the floodplain warehouse and get some of this paint. And they needed about 30 or 40 gallons of it. And I go over there, and we don't have any kind of paint like that. So they had some white, and they had some various colors and quarts and gallons. There was no 5-gallon cans. Everything was gallons and quarts. And my job was to find this paint or make it or get it. And they had a little paint shop off in one of the buildings. So I told the crew we took all the paint off the shelves, everything we had that was light colored. We dumped it in this barrel, and we had an electric motor stern, and dumped everything we could get our hands on in there, and still no orangey yellow color. And I don't know what the devil we're gonna do. My job was to get this paint, don't come back without it. So there was a barrel of powdered red lead. And I took a shovel and I started to shovel this red lead into it. And lo and behold, it came out a beautiful orangey yellow color. And we stirred and stirred and got all the lumps. Many of these quart cans of paint were solidified. We dug it out with screwdrivers and things. We mixed and mixed till we got all the lumps out of it. And we thought it was pretty close to the color, so we loaded it in a barrel and the truck and come back, and it was okay. But it was just more or less an experiment. we hit on a good color.
Did Buttrees ever consider going union while you were here?
Never any talk of union in those days. Just damn glad to have a job.
How do you think they would have reacted to a union coming in?
Well, I think an organizer had been laughed at, thoroughly laughed at. The government scale was set up. It didn't matter if you were an experienced machinist or welder or whatever. If you had 30 years experience, you didn't get any more than the guy did. And after 6 months, you didn't get a dollar and a quarter or something. It was just that on through. If you worked 10 years, it was still that. And it was the same with the salaried workers. We started in at the waiters and dishwashers and people like that in the barracks got $90 a month, my recollection. It had some kind of a pay scale, and then the government workers, we had CAF-2, that was $1,440 a year, $120 a month. And I don't recollect, I think probably there were increment increases in that, but I never got one. And many times we didn't get paid overtime. We got what was considered comp, call it comp time or compensatory time. If you work 2 hours overtime, you're supposed to get time off some other time. And they would accumulate that. I remember one time I went back to Plentywood. I had about 4 or 5 days coming and took it on comp time.
What kind of shifts did you work?
I was lucky enough to always have day shift, 8 to 5.
Was the store open 24 hours?
Oh, no, no. No, that store, I think we worked, well, they did evenings too, by golly. Certain evenings, maybe Friday and Saturday evening. But 6 o'clock, I think it was 8 to 6 or something like that.
If you could describe for us the work that you did as a clerk for the Corps of Engineers.
I was a storekeeper. Over here at the tunnel warehouse, we had a rather limited supply of hardware, but we had a tool room, and men would come in for various types of tools, and we wrote a little ticket, and they had to leave their time check. All workers had a time check. And they would give us this time check, and we'd get them about anything they wanted, a jackhammer, a hose, a shovel, a pick, an axe, a pipe wrench, a crescent wrench, a screwdriver, just about anything they wanted, we give it on that tool check. And when he'd bring it back, and we give him back his tool check. Hardware like nuts, bolts, pipe fittings, so many things in those days were considered accountable property. A goggles, a saw, a hammer, an axe, most any tool, pair of boots, was called accountable property. And that had to be checked in and out. Something like red lead or paint or oil or stuff like that was consumable. But the accountable thing, they had to bring it back. Or you got charged for it.
Why did you decide to leave the butchery store and go to the clerk store?
Well, there was that difference in salary. We kind of looked up to these government workers. They got sick leave, which Buttrees didn't give. They give a vacation time. You got 30 days of annual leave, they call it. If you worked 11 months, you got 1 month's vacation. You had 15 days of sick leave. And then you paid into a retirement fund that you could look forward to, and Buttrees had nothing like that. This is even before the days of Social Security, see. And that increase, what the heck, $10 a month was great.
Was there a lot of competition for that job?
No, I had a recommendation from an inspector, and he had turned in a recommendation. About all I had to do was to come over here to a head office somewhere and introduce myself and tell him I wanted the job and signed it up.
How did you come about getting a recommendation from him?
Through the store, I knew this man. I sold him furniture and clothing, and small community. You got to know a lot of people. And can't even recall his name now, but he was one of the head inspectors. I think I started out under the title of a sub-inspector, but in government activities, oftentimes you're misassigned. The government probably had a certain allotment of storekeepers. And if that was full, I had to give you something else. I know that when I was an administrator in El Toro, we could only hire so many in a category. And so we'd hire people in a category out of their really type of work. So I think for several months I was a sub-inspector doing storekeeper work.
Back at Buttry's, what were the popular type of clothes that people would want to buy?
Well, you had your regular work clothes. Bib overalls were still popular in those days for $3.95. And jean type of overalls, we had inexpensive ones for about $1.98, and we had good ones for $2.95 or $3.95. Ties were 50 cents, 15.75. A dollar tie was a beautiful thing in those days. Shirts sold for, I think, the Arrow shirts were $1.95, $2. An awful popular thing that we never could seem to keep in stock was the jockey short. I guess the jockey short was pretty new in the 30s. And our boss would never, we were always out of 30s and 32s, always. And we'd try to order large quantities, and our boss would never let us order like 10 dozen of them. You know, he'd hold us down, and we always run out of 30 and 32s. But you had a general type, a gray or blue cambray shirt was very popular for work, and a tan. Tan pants and tan shirts, the Army engineers wore a kind of a matched shirt and pants, and this was khaki, and that was very popular. But the working man bought pant overall, jeans as we call them now.
Did you get a discount on clothes because you worked there?
Yes, we as employees got a 15% discount. We had to charge it, and then the bookkeeper subtracted. If we bought a lot of clothes and didn't want to have it all charged to one paycheck, we could make a deal with the bookkeeper to prorate it. But we got a 15% discount.
Did that go with groceries and other sundry items?
We got 5% on the groceries. The manager of the grocery store lived in Glasgow, and he had a pickup, and several of the boys rode with him, and they would bring this pickup back loaded with perishables, fruit and vegetables. And he'd have that old pickup loaded right to the axle and stuff. Perishables, the fruit and vegetables, were pretty hard to come by in those days. Rather limited supply.
Where were you at the day that the dam broke in 1938?
I had left here. I was in Los Angeles. But my wife was here. It was my wife then. She was running the theater in.
Do you recall any other major catastrophes or accidents that happened while you were here?
Not particularly. We'd hear every now and then the contractors, when they were digging the basic tunnels, they killed off quite a few with poor engineering and poor safety practices on the tunnel end. A machine would whiplash and hit a man, and there'd be a slight cave-in or something. We'd just hear that word of mouth.
What kind of impression did you have when you first moved to Fort Peck with all the people working here in a boom town just starting up?
Well, for a young man, it was exciting. So much activity, everything was a bustle and hustle. And new, And for a little farm boy, it was pretty exciting, I guess.
Did you know people when you first moved here?
Not particularly, only the ones I worked with. Once in a while, I'd run into somebody that had come. Some of my high school friends were here, and people from the hometown, you ran into them, visit.
Was there a lot of good camaraderie between workers or between people that lived here?
I think so. I think it generally was. Back in those days, everybody was so darn poor that you're glad to get work and glad to have some money to spend.
When you look back on the time that you spent here, could you ever envision that the Fort Peck Dam and Reservoir was going to be what it is today, the time you were working here?
I don't think as a young man that I had any idea. I had seen like a pencil sketch of what the dam would be. I don't suppose this dam was dredged half full by that time. I'd come down from Havre in the summer of 34. Yes, summer of 34, a carload of us drove down from Havre and toured the site, and everything was just dust. And I can remember this like an anthill of hundreds and hundreds of these little old dump trucks. Compared to the dump truck of today, these things were little pickups. They were so small compared to earth-moving equipment of today. But they were using what we called elevated graders. They were stripping away the soil. And they would haul it off to what they call a spoil area. And those little trucks just zipping and zipping and zipping. Many of them didn't have cabs or fenders or anything else. Just go, go, go. And all pretty exciting for a young man just off the farm.
When you look back, what do you think that you enjoyed or liked the most out of being at Fort Peck?
Oh, I don't know. To me, going to shows was fun, and the dances. And you see, you could get in the car and go up to one of the dance halls anytime you wanted to. And they didn't have music 24 hours a day, but any evening, starting maybe 7 or 8, you could dance.
You recall President Roosevelt's?
Yes, I was here. I was lucky enough to have been in Havre the summer before, and Roosevelt came through, and they let us out of the store. And I can remember this sea of people. We were packed so tight that you just kind of wove like wheat. And he spoke from the back of the train, and then when they backed the train in here, I was not too awfully close, but I was went out of the warehouse and stood on the dock of the warehouse and got a good look at him. That was pretty exciting to have the President of the United States come to Montana.
Was he well liked?
Yes, Roosevelt was a popular man. Of course, I suppose these work WPA and I can't think of all the numbers. When I was working at Havre, I was making 25 cents an hour. And then I went on a salary of $60 a month, and as a monthly salary person, they could work you all the hours they wanted to. They worked you 60, 70 hours a week, and you got $60 a month. Well, when they started in WPA, Work Progress Administration, my age, these numbers won't come
PWA.
Back, but...
PWA?
Well, it wasn't that. They addicted that you could only work 40 hours. And of course they were working us 50, 52, and 60 hours a week. And when they cut you back to 40 hours, then they had to stagger time because they worked the store evenings and that. And I remember I'd have a day off where I'd only come in and work a half a day to cut this time down. I was happy about that. Put in a lot less hours and you got the same pay.
Did you vote for Roosevelt?
Well, I never voted until I was, here you just didn't think about registering to vote. They didn't go after young people. I don't suppose I voted until I got out in California and was in my 30s. But I would have. Roosevelt got credit for an awful lot of these make work things, WPA and the CCC camps and all of that. I often wondered where in the world the government got the money to finance this. You see, this dam didn't sell bonds or anything like the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. They sold bonds to build that. But where the government got the money to run WPA and the CCC camps and all of this, I never could figure out where they got the money.
When you look back at the years you did spend here, what do you think you, how do you think it affected your life after that? Do you think it had an effect?
Well, I can't say particularly. I was glad to get off the farm, and as I say, I started college. I was going to start pre-med. I think I always wanted to be a chiropractor, and the local chiropractor stimulated my thoughts a lot. But I just put it on hold when I couldn't get enough money to pay the tuition and buy books for a second year of pre-med. I just and I went to work for Buttrees, and it was nice to have spending money. So it went on hold until about 1946, 47. I quit a good government job to go away to school in.
When you started seeing the project coming to a close here, were you, was your job security on the line too?
I wasn't here. See, I went away in 38. Mm-hmm. There was an awful lot of work to do after that.
It wasn't, the work wasn't tailing off by...
Oh, no, no, it was going full blast. As I say, my recollection would be that the building of the dam, the filling of the hydraulic fill, probably halfway up the hill. So there's an awful lot of work to...
Why did you decide to leave?
Well, I'd heard good things about California. I thought it'd be a good place to live, I guess. No winters, no snow, no cold weather. And I thought probably that I could advance faster than I could here. Really here, it looked like $14.40 a year for a long time to go. The only way, you see, there were a number of us at $14.40 called a CAF-2, and your boss would be a CAF-3 at $1,630, and if he didn't die off or something, there was no advancement.
Did you go to California by yourself?
Yeah, I drove an old 1937 Ford all by myself. That was kind of scary for a young kid off the farm, too, I suppose.
You mentioned that your wife now was working here at the time. You weren't married when you left?
No.
How did you meet up again?
I sent for her. She sold the concession here to another lady and got on the train and come out. And I guess it was about the same for this Burl Downing, our friend. She was an usherette and was, I think, then a cashier selling the tickets in the theater. She was in love with her man, and so we told the girls, come on out and we'll get married.
Did they left together then?
No, it's staggered. Burl Downing come first and they got married. They were pretty close together because we stood up for them and they stood up for us.
Were you able to keep close contact with friends that you'd met here or people you worked with after you left?
Not particularly. It seemed like in those days people didn't write like they do and you didn't call. It cost too much for long distance calls. And in fact, I didn't write to my family much. But when they come out there, we lived together some, a couple of different apartments, and then we moved to San Diego from Los Angeles, and then Carlson's moved later, I don't know, some months, or maybe as much, well, it could have been a year and a half later that they moved to San Diego, from Los Angeles to San Diego. Didn't want to cover that thing.
Well, that's all I have. Do you have any other comments you'd like to make?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
I appreciate it. It's been very informative.